Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of the Song of Solomon with The Tempter Arrives. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. The Song of Solomon, as we have discussed, is written in the form of a drama in five acts, as set forth by C.D. Ginsburg in his commentary on the book. And I believe that it tells a story about a love triangle between a country girl, her country boy lover, to whom she is betrothed, and we discussed in detail what that means. It's more than an engagement. They're legally bound. And then the third member of the love triangle is Solomon, the king, who tries to steal her away from her beloved. And in this book, I believe we see an example of the kind of love and loyalty that we should have toward God, and the kind of love that he has for us. Now, last time we saw that Solomon took the country girl back to Jerusalem, and yet she remained loyal to her shepherd boy lover and the vow she had taken to him. Last time she had just related a dream to some of the courtiers or court ladies, talking about that in this dream her worst nightmare was that her beloved had come to her at night and she was so sleepy and annoyed that she hadn't wanted him. And she forgot about her care for him until it was too late. She thought, what am I doing? I'm leaving my beloved out in the rain. I'm leaving him out in the cold. What have I done? And she goes to the door and he's already gone. And she missed him. That's her nightmare. And we were continuing with Act 4 in Song of Solomon chapter 5 and verse 8. Where she says, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am lovesick. So after relating her dream to the court ladies, she charges them that if they find her shepherd and find him, well, she doesn't know where he is, well, she isn't with him, that they will tell her shepherd that she is lovesick. Verse 9, what is your beloved more than another beloved, O fairest among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you so charge us? So these court ladies are a little skeptical. They wonder, how can your beloved be so special? How can he be any different than all the other men who are around? You know, every woman thinks that her beloved is something special. What makes yours so special? After all, she didn't seem to think he was so special in her dream. She sent him away. And so these are probably some of the less sympathetic court ladies. But they say, who is this guy? Why is he so special? Verse 10, my beloved is white and ruddy, chief among 10,000. Well, maybe you've noticed throughout here that as she has encountered her shepherd boy lover, that he has described her glowingly multiple times, but she hasn't really said much. She's expressed her love for him, but she hasn't described him in glowing detail like he has described her. And perhaps she's more shy or more reserved than he was. And typically, the men sometimes are the ones who pursue anyway. But at this point, she is pricked. And she is provoked into expressing what she really thinks about her beloved. Because after all, he's been called into question, that he's not that special. And so provoked, she pours out her real thoughts about him. Now, she describes him as white and ruddy, chief among 10,000. And the idea here seems to be that if you had an army, you have just a mass of troops, but then you have the leader, the commander, and he has a banner that he carries. And that's the way when you're in the midst of the battle and you need orders and you want to know who is the commander, who's in charge, who can I go to find out what I should do next, well, you look for the banner. Because the banner marks the special one out. The banner marks the one who is different from all the other soldiers out. So that's the idea, she says here, is that he is like that one in the army carrying the banner. He is marked out among all the rest. He's marked out from the mass. He is indeed finer than all of them. Verse 11, his head is like the finest gold. His locks are wavy and black as a raven. So she starts to describe his body parts, and she says that his head is like the finest gold. Now, that's not his hair color, as if he was a blonde. Rather, it's talking about his head, and gold symbolized excellence and beauty. So when she says his head is like gold, it's excellent, it's beautiful. And then his locks are wavy. Wavy or curly is the idea of the word. And they are black as a raven. And jet black at the time was a highly prized color. And his hair is jet black. So that's how she describes it. Verse 12. His eyes are like doves by the rivers of waters, washed with milk and fitly set. So she says, his eyes are like doves by the rivers of waters, washed with milk. Now the idea is not that his eyes are like the eyes of a dove, but she is comparing his eyes to doves. Now doves in Israel were either a deep blue color or a gray color. So she's either describing his eyes as deep blue or gray. And that's probably the irises, what color they are. And she says they're like doves bathing in milk. So that's the whites of his eyes. The deep blue or gray eyes, whichever he has, are bathing in milk. That's his eyes. And then they are fitly set. They are set like jewels in his face. Verse 13. His cheeks are like a bed of spices, banks of scented herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. So she compares his cheeks to a bed growing spices. Now, why does she do that? Well, I think there's no doubt about it. It's because he's growing a beard. And we know it was very common with Israelite men that they grew beards. So his cheeks are growing a beard. She compares him to a bed growing spices. And then his lips she compares to lilies. Now, I think we often think of lilies, we think of white. We talk about lily white. But this would be the crown imperial lily, and it's a deep red color. So she's comparing his lips to a deep red lily, a crown imperial lily, and not a white lily. So his lips are like lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. Of course, that's a perfume. Then verse 14, his hands are rods of gold, set with beryl. His body is carved ivory, inlaid with sapphires. So in verse 14 there, she compares his hands or his fingers, not his hands, but his fingers, to rods of gold, it says. Or basically golden cylinders. His fingers are like golden cylinders, and then set with beryl. So his nails are like gems inlaid on the golden cylinders, is the idea. And then his body is carved ivory inlaid with sapphires. So she compares his body or his skin to white ivory. Now people have argued about what exactly was the color of the ancient Israelites. And it's been argued back and forth. Nobody knows for sure. The Israelites today are more or less intermarried with the people they've lived among. And so the Israelites in Europe look like Europeans, and the Israelites in Africa look like Africans, and the Israelites in China look like Chinese, and it's hard to tell what the Israelites looked like originally, because now they just look like the peoples among whom they live among because of intermarriage. But this boy, at least, she describes him as having skin like ivory, so he at least has white skin. And then inlaid with sapphires. The idea is probably his blue tunic. That his blue tunic is like a blue sapphire covering the white ivory of his skin. Then verse 15, his legs are pillars of marble, set on bases of fine gold. His countenance is like Lebanon, excellent as the cedars. So his legs on his feet she compares to marble columns on golden bases. And then his countenance, that means his entire aspect. If you just look at him as a whole, his entire aspect is like Lebanon. And Lebanon, remember, I've talked about that before, it was a beautiful forest in the northern part of the land God promised to Israel, a beautiful forest. And it's beautiful and majestic with the finest of cedars. The most expensive cedar wood came from Lebanon. So she says his whole countenance, his whole aspect is like that. Then verse 16, his mouth is most sweet. Yes, he is altogether lovely. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. So she finishes up with his mouth, or this probably means his voice. She finishes with his sweet voice. And remember, he had commented her sweet voice in chapter 2. He wanted to hear her sweet voice. And now she says the same thing about his voice. His voice is sweet. She loves to hear it. And of course, she would love to hear it even now. She's lonely in Jerusalem, away from him. And then she sums it up, altogether lovely. That means he is fervently desired by her, in other words. She fervently desires him. And she calls him her beloved and her friend. Now, that's always a good thing when those two go together. When your beloved, when your lover is also your friend. The kind of person you want to hang out with, even if he wasn't your beloved. He's a good friend. But she describes him as both her beloved and her friend. Now, that is quite a description. And surely the daughters of Jerusalem must be impressed by this passionate description of her beloved shepherd. But this makes me wonder. Suppose you were pricked. Suppose you were provoked. Suppose someone said to you, "Who is this Jesus Christ that you claim to love and worship? How is he special? How is he any different from anybody else's God?" Now, the Buddhists, they love Buddha. And the Muslims, they love Allah. And the Hindus, they love all their different gods. And the Jews, well, they claim to love Jehovah. So why is your Jesus Christ so special? Why do you say he's any different? It seems to me he's just like all the other gods, isn't he? Why is your Jesus Christ so special? Well, if somebody asked you that, could you describe our beloved Lord Jesus Christ like this country girl describes her beloved? Could you explain with passion and with fervor and with love why he means so much to you? Why he's so special, why he's so different from any other God. If you were challenged like these court ladies challenged this young girl, could you glowingly describe the glories of Jesus Christ? Well, that brings us to chapter 6 and verse 1. Where is your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Where is your beloved turned aside, that we may seek him with you? Well, it seems that the court ladies are impressed. And how could they help but be impressed after this description of hers? And again, would you be able to impress people with your description of Jesus Christ so that they would want to meet him too? That's the important thing, right? So they wonder, where is he gone? We'd like to know where he is so we could check out this guy you've described so glowingly. See if we really think he's that great. We want to seek him with you. She responds, verse 2, "My beloved has gone to his garden, to the beds of spices, to feed his flocks in the gardens, and to gather lilies." So she responds, and I think she responds very vaguely. He's gone out to the gardens. In other words, he's returned to the fields. He's going to feed, not himself, but his flocks in the gardens. So, oh, he's gone off to feed his flocks, you know, do shepherding stuff, and to gather lilies. That probably means he's shepherding his flocks out among the lilies. Well, that's very vague, and she probably doubts the motives of these court ladies. Remember, their plan was that he sneaked into Jerusalem, and they consummated their relationship, because remember, they were betrothed, they were legally bound. But until they were married, her brothers, who were in charge of her family, her father was dead, so her brothers could have procured a divorce, gone over their heads, and they could have had no say about it, and they could have annulled the marriage, and then Solomon could have married her. However, once they're married, well, then only her shepherd could procure a divorce. So they had consummated their relationship, and then he'd run away to hide. Now, hopefully Solomon was a good enough king that he wouldn't have, if he got a hold of the shepherd boy, executed his rival. But he could have at least tried to force him to give a divorce so he could marry the girl. So the best thing was for him to get away and nobody know where he is. So she's not about to give away his location to these court ladies and risk them telling it to Solomon. So she just answers vaguely. Then she says, verse 3, "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He feeds his flock among the lilies." So she repeats her dedication to him. And again, even if they were only betrothed, then these court ladies don't necessarily know that they've consummated their relationship, but even if they were only betrothed, she belongs to him and he to her. Betrothal was legally binding, like I said. So she says, "He belongs to me, not to you, so you have no reason to seek him. He's off feeding his flock among the lilies. I'm not going to tell you where." Well, at this point, Solomon, the tempter, enters the scene. And so now we have the showdown with Solomon. So Solomon comes to tempt her once again. Now, he had tempted her once before when he first picked her up, found her out in the country, and took her into his train. Remember what he said in chapter 1 and verse 10 when he said, "Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. We will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver." In other words, he was promising her, "If you will marry me, well, I'll give you all kinds of jewelry. I'll give you all kinds of fancy clothes and ornaments. You'll be a beautiful princess, a beautiful queen." After all, what could her shepherd boy offer her? As decoration, shells, flowers, nothing expensive, not gold and jewelry and fine clothes. Probably homespun country clothes is all she'll get with him. So he was tempting her there with the lust of the eyes, with beautiful things that are often so near to the heart of young girls. And remember, John says in 1 John 2:16, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world." And Satan, when he tempts, and it seems Solomon too, when he tempts this girl here, he tempts her with these three things. And he starts off with the lust of the eyes. But that hadn't worked. She loved her country life, and she didn't care if she had a lot of rich ornaments. To her, flowers and shells and things like those were beautiful ornament. She didn't want gold and jewels. So now he's going to tempt her again, and this time I believe he's going to tempt her with the pride of life. So Solomon enters the scene, and in verse 4 he says, "Oh, my love, you are as beautiful as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners." So he calls her his love, and he says, "You're beautiful as Tirzah." Now that doesn't mean anything to us if we say, "What's Tirzah?" Well, Tirzah was a city. Its name means delightful. And it was apparently a very delightful, a very beautiful and pleasant city in Israel. In fact, later, when the nation split into two, after the days of Solomon and the days of his son, in the northern kingdom, their capital for a time became Tirzah, because it was a very delightful city. It was a beautiful place for the capital, until later, under Omri, it switched to Samaria. But at first, Tirzah was the capital of the northern kingdom, so it was a very beautiful place. And then he mentions Jerusalem, lovely as Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem was at the height of its beauty during Solomon's reign. He had decorated it spectacularly. In fact, he had made silver so common in Jerusalem that it wasn't even worth anything. There was so much of it. And there were gold and jewels and ivory and all kinds of things. So Jerusalem was lovely at this time, and he's comparing her to Jerusalem. And then he says awesome or awe-inspiring as an army with banners. So we imagine an army, they're all in their dress uniforms. They're all carrying their banners. They're all marching. They're awe-inspiring. And he says, "You're like that." Verse 5, "Turn your eyes away from me, for they have overcome me. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Gilead." So she's looking at him, maybe a bit incredulously, like, "Are you for real, buddy?" And so he tries to impress her. He says, "Oh, stop looking at me. I can't take it anymore. Your gaze is just overwhelming me." Well, that's pretty melodramatic, isn't it? But it's sort of the thing that a young girl might find romantic, and Solomon is very clever in such things. "So I can't stand your gaze. Turn away your eyes from me," he says. And then he compares her hair to a flock of goats going down from Gilead. Now, goats at this time in Israel were known for having a very fine black hair. And so he's describing her hair like that. And when it was clean and in the sun, it would shine very brightly, the sun off the black hair, and it would be hard to look at goats when they were clean and out in the sun. So he's comparing her hair to that, to the beautiful black fine hair of goats. And then it's leaping down from the mountains of Gilead. We imagine mountain goats leaping down from the mountains, and her hair is like it's leaping down her shoulders in waves, like the goats coming down the mountains. Verse 6, "Your teeth are like a flock of sheep which have come up from the washing. Everyone bears twins, and none is barren among them." So he's using similar language to her shepherd here. But I don't think that's too unusual. Young men in any culture at any given time probably have similar figures that they use, go around among young men, they all know them, and that they use with their lady loves. So that he uses some of the same figures as their shepherd is not too unusual. They're both living in the same culture at the same time. But he definitely mixes in other things that her shepherd boy doesn't do. So he compares her teeth to sheep They've come up from the washing. Of course, sheep could probably get quite muddy and dirty at times, but if you just wash them, they'd be white and shining. And then everyone bears twins. The idea there is probably everyone has its mate. So it's not talking about everyone has its twin right and left tooth, but its mate, top and bottom tooth. And none is barren among them. Now, we know that the options aren't twins or barrenness. I mean, everybody doesn't bear twins. So again, this is probably speaking of a mate. None is bereaved among them. Bereaved to its mate, in other words. She has all her teeth. None are missing. They're all glowing white like sheep from the washing. Then verse 7, like a piece of pomegranate are your temples behind your veil. Again, her shepherd lover used the same thing. Probably a phrase that a lot of the young men used at the time. And this talks about her temples, or perhaps her cheeks are like pieces of a pomegranate. Well, now he comes to the difficult issue. How is he going to sell past this? Verse 8. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. So Solomon, the sticking point in him trying to sell himself to this young girl is the fact that he is a raging polygamist. And he admits it here. Now, at this point, we're early in Solomon's career, so he only has 60 queens and 80 concubines. Now, we know he ended up with 700 queens and 300 concubines. So I guess he upped the rate of queens and down the rate of concubines after a while. But how is he going to sell a young girl on marrying him as opposed to her shepherd boy lover when he is such a polygamist? And he even admits, there are virgins without number. I've just started collecting wives. There are plenty more where those came from. Well, how is he going to convince her past that? Well, he says, verse 9, my dove, my perfect one, is the only one. The only one of her mother. The favorite of the one who bore her. The daughters saw her and called her blessed. The queens and the concubines, and they praised her. So he seems to say, here's the thing. I know women. I have 140 of them. I know women. What does some country boy who never had a wife, what does he know? But I know women. And so I recognize one who's special. I recognize one who's unique when I see her. So see, that's how he's selling it. Now, that's just complete nonsense and flattery, of course, but some young girls would be taken in by it. Oh, this man who knows women so well thinks that I'm special. She's the only one of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. Even your mother must find you the favorite, he says. The daughters saw her and called her blessed, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. Now, why would the other queens praise her? Maybe he's indicating she's more beautiful than they are. Well, some women will praise a woman who's more beautiful. Others might get kind of resentful. But see, I think he might be promising her that they will have to praise her. And why would they have to do that unless she was the highest queen? Now, we might find this unlikely. Because after all, most of the women Solomon married were princesses. Remember, that's how he was keeping the peace in Israel, is he was marrying the daughters of all the kings of the nations around Israel. And then they're not going to attack their son-in-law. So he's marrying all these princesses. So why would he promote a Jewish country girl to the position of queen? Well, first of all, I think we have to realize that the woman who was the most obvious one to be the top queen and produce the heir would have been the daughter of Pharaoh of Egypt. She in the Bible is presented as Solomon's highest queen, and he builds a beautiful palace for her and all this. And yet we find that Solomon's heir, Rehoboam, was actually the daughter of an Ammonitess, and not a Pharaoh's daughter at all. So it seems that there was some problem there. Either she was barren and couldn't bear children, or maybe she bore only daughters. So it could be his top queen wasn't producing an heir. And then there's the fact that there probably were many in his own court who weren't too happy with the idea that the next king, the next one to take the throne, would be produced by a foreign woman, even if she was a princess. And there could have been many in his court who would have liked it if Solomon would have married an Israelite girl and promoted her son to take the throne rather than the son of some foreign woman. So it could be this would have been a very popular policy in Israel among the common people and even among his own courtiers. So I think it is quite possible that he could have offered her this. And if so, this would certainly be tempting her with the pride of life. To be the top queen, to have her son sit on the throne. That's a temptation. Then he finishes up verse 10. Who is she who looks forth as the morning? Fair as the moon, clear as the sun, awesome as an army with banners. And this seems to be what he suggests the other queens will say to her. That she is, they'll praise her as being more beautiful than they are. and they'll look at her as just as awe-inspiring as he does. So this is Solomon's temptation, and we wonder, will this girl be able to stand up to it? So in this portion, we see that the Shulamite describes her beloved in glowing detail when called upon to do so. Can we describe our Lord Jesus Christ with the same passionate fervor? The tempter comes to her, and having already tempted her with the lust of the eyes, he now tempts her with the pride of life. And I ask you, if we were in the same situation, would we stand up to the enemy's temptations? If he promised us riches, and if he promised us the world, would we trade in our Lord for them, or would we stay loyal? That's a question we all need to answer for ourselves.
If only we knew God like this woman knows her betrothed. If only we could express our love for Christ as this woman does for the one she longs to be with. May we always strive to return to God the unrelenting love He has for us. May we always strive to endure in our relationship with Him. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on The Tempter Arrives. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of the Song of Solomon with The Showdown. Thank you for joining us today. We trust that you are learning that the more we study God's Word, the more we can know God. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.